Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, many of you tune into this show to hear analysis from our expert guests and input from other listeners in order to understand the world better. And in the end, you may trust in yourself and your own experience as a guide. But my next guest might warn us to beware of our own analysis. Why? Because humans are just not that smart. Journalist David McRaney's popular blog, You Are Not So Smart, is now a book. And he's here to take on the cognitive biases, experience-based conclusions, and logical fallacies we all use to, as he says, incorrectly interpret ourselves and our world. David McRaney, welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And let's start with something that came up earlier in this show that, in a way, you touch on in the book. I mentioned the Herman Cain quote, "If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself." Is this an example of what you call the just world fallacy?
It truly is. That's the just world fallacy, and it's not just a piece of political rhetoric. It's not just a piece of philosophical musing. It's something that science has an opinion on, and studies have come back over and over again to show that some of us have a sense that we would like the bad guys should lose and the good guys should win, and we'd like to see the world in a way that is just and fair. And if you have that belief, and it's almost akin to believing in karma, you find it really easy to blame the victim. You know, when someone is, if a woman goes out and she's walking in a bad neighborhood wearing alluring clothing, then she bears some blame in her own attack. Or bullies, people who are bullied at school, you know, they don't stand up for themselves, and they bear some sort of blame in the bullying, because in a just and fair world, the good guys, if they would just do the right thing, they would win.
And, so we have a bias, you're saying, toward looking at the world as if it is more just than it is.
Right.
Not the people who call the show, by the way, but go ahead.
Right. I'm sure you and myself and everyone else were quite astute. It came out of studies that were done by Melvin Lerner in the 60s, and he was noticing that when he had to go to institutions where people had to deal with misery day in and day out, psychological institutions and medical practitioners and stuff, that they would start to look down on the people who were harmed the most, and not like they didn't hate them. They just had to come up with a way to deal with the barrage of having to deal with so much misery. And
that there was some reason that these people were in these circumstances.
Right. And sometimes, you know, it's infuriating to think that lazy cheats, you know, the con artists can get ahead, and people like firemen and policemen, they put in so much time and effort, and they end up getting a little little pay or little recognition. You want to believe that hard work and virtue will lead to success, because that's what you're doing. In reality, evil often does prosper and never pays the price, and it's a really tough lesson to live with.
One chapter in your book is on the availability heuristic. You say that we think that we base our understanding of the world on many examples and wide-ranging evidence, but in reality, we are more likely to form a worldview based on just one example of something if that's what happens to be available to us. That's the availability heuristic?
Correct. You know, a lot of what I talk about is about speed of thought. We were able to avoid being eaten for a couple million years by going for the shortcuts to thinking. And in the best situations, those serve us well, but we don't always live in the best situations. We certainly don't live in the same conditions that our mind was forged in. So the availability heuristic is when we predict when something is going to happen based on how easily we can think of an example from our own lives or from the media. So, you know, if you know someone who maybe has gotten sick from a flu shot, then you might be unlikely to take a flu shot in the future. Even if somebody hands you the numbers and say, this is statistically very safe, in fact, you should do this because you need to avoid getting sick in the future, and you'll be like, well, I know a guy who got sick, and remember, and you're much more likely to base your decision on the anecdotes than you are from the statistics.
Interesting. So, listeners, let's use the availability heuristic for a short call-in. We'll just do this for a few minutes, but call us with an example from your own life when you've based a belief on one piece of evidence simply because that was the evidence available. How did you discover later on that your view was incomplete? Don't be shy. We're all guilty of this. No judgments. just give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for David McRaney, author of You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. Let's put a couple of examples of the availability heuristic on the table. If you think you've ever been guilty of it, made a conclusion based on the evidence that you saw in front of your own two eyes, and then realized later on, oh, that was really wrong. I just didn't have enough information. Why do you 212-433-9692? Why do you include in the subtitle of your book that we have too many Facebook friends?
Oh, that's a great one. That's one of those concrete scientific findings over the last decade or so. Robin Dunbar is a sociologist, and he's pretty well known in the science community right now, and he's a sort of a rising star. I think you'll hear a lot more from him in the public soon.
He's been here not that long ago.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. Robin Dunbar has this thing called Dunbar's number. It's 150, and it can be a little higher, it can be a little lower, and we can use tools to magnify it, but it's not that you can't keep a Rolodex in your head of names of individuals, and it's not that you can't remember when you're prompted that, oh, yeah, I know that guy, I met that guy. It's that you can't maintain a current relationship with more than about 150 people. That's when the brain cries uncle. When I mean a relationship, it's the soap opera. It's what did this person get you for Christmas? What is this person's favorite food? When has this person – is this person in an argument with this person? It's keeping up with all those relationships. And we do that through something called social grooming. If you were – we're primates, but the ape version of our primate lineage, they social groom by picking parasites off of each other, rubbing each other's fur. You know, they actually groom physically. We socially groom by having Super Bowl parties, or by going out for drinks, or sharing photographs, keeping up with each other through phone calls and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of time and effort and brain capacity to do, and we pretty much max out at 150. It's a glass that once it's full, it spills over when we add more to it. And if you fall out of touch with someone, say at work, they will eventually fade out of your life because you can't maintain that relationship.
Let's take a caller with an example of the availability heuristic in his life. George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, what happened to you?
Hi, good morning. It was a perception I had about Sir Thomas More of England. I always thought you've seen the movie and read the play, Man for All Seasons, and that's the vision I guess most Americans have of him. But I heard Christopher Hitchens talking about him one time, and he mentioned that he was responsible for the beheading or burning at the stake of several heretics in England at the time when he was the... the Attorney General of England or anything like that. And it sort of rocked my world. I looked it up, and, well, of course, there's another source that says that's true, not Hitchens at all. And it sort of rocked my world ever since.
It's George, thank you. And that's an interesting example because it's not so much about, like, a decision he had to make about buying real estate and he didn't know the foundation was cracked or something like that. It's kind of coming to a judgment about history, a judgment about politics, in a sense.
Yeah, we're motivated. We do a lot of motivated reasoning. We have we construct these lenses that we look at the world from which we look at the world, and those lenses are based off of how we more often about how we would like the world to be more than how it actually is. And we use things like confirmation bias and hindsight bias to change not only our current perceptions but our memories to. Inflate our self-esteem, and to if we've decided that we are aligned with a certain group, we will find ways to defend that as if we were defending our own self.
One more reassuring misconception from your book is that we tend to think we panic when disaster strikes, but you say that in reality we often become abnormally calm in a crisis, and that you call the normalcy bias.
Right. Yeah. Reassuring. The normalcy bias is one of those things. I had never heard of this until I started researching for new topics on the book. I wanted the book to have a lot of new stuff that wasn't on the blog, and it's pretty astounding. I know if you are about to be in like a car wreck or maybe you have a gun pulled on you or something like that, you'll experience something called fear bradycardia, where you freeze. But this is something else. This is when you're in a situation that sort of comes to a slow boil. It's impending doom. It could be a flood or a building on fire. It could be a a ship sinking or some other disaster of that nature, a tornado coming your way. And people, oftentimes, they will, since they're in their mind, they're begging for the world to return to normal. So they will engage in acts of normalcy. And you would think, based on like watching movies and TV shows, that when the building's on fire, people will go, "Let's get out of here," and they run down the stairs. But what happens more often than not is that people will, they will stand up, they will take a minute to think about what's going on, they'll ask other people what they're doing, they will...
Right, it's the normalcy bias, a.k.a. denial?
It is denial. It's in a way, I mean, you're wishing the world was normal, so you engage in normal behavior. In the weirdest study that showed how people will do this, say they would have like five people in a room, four of them were actors, one of them was the subject, and they're filling out a questionnaire, and they slowly let smoke billow into the room from an air vent, and the actors have been told to not draw much attention to what's going on, and when the person becomes alarmed, act like everything is normal, and tell them, hey, we should just go ahead and finish this questionnaire. And, of course, the person gets alarmed. They look around, but they as long as the actors aren't doing anything out of the ordinary and they keep prompting the person to stay still, a person will sit in a room and do the questionnaire. Sometimes, by the time the smoke has filled the room up so much, they can't even see the paper in front of them.
Rob in Nassau County is calling in with another example of the availability heuristic. So, Rob, you saw one piece of evidence and made a wrong generalization?
Yes, I have. I think we're inclined to believe gossip very easily. So, for example, I've been told that a girl is sexually promiscuous, and I'm very apt to believe it. I find that happens constantly.
All right. Yeah, we'll just leave that right where it is. Sally in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Shelley, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What's your example?
I was very convinced that much of the financial crisis in Europe was linked to our own mortgage-backed securities issues. I was certain that Greece also had been investing in these, trumped up, basically worthless mortgage-backed securities and the credit default swaps. But I learned from somebody who is a banker in Italy and is very knowledgeable about what's going on in Greece that actually the problems in Greece have much more to do with the corruption of the body politic mm-hmm. there.
And Shelley, I'm going to leave it there for time. But on her point, is there a bias toward thinking that other people are just like us or other societies are just like ours and we're not as smart as we think we are because of that?
Well, when we're trying to look into the minds of other people, we're very social creatures. So it's difficult for us to look at institutions as being cold and look at them in an objective way that doesn't involve thinking about the motivations of the people who are inside of them. And I know the one chapter I write about the fundamental attribution error, where we tend to engage in when we inspect the behavior of other people, we look at them as characters instead of looking at them as being influenced by their surroundings. But one thing that popped out in what your caller had just mentioned was she went to someone she felt was an expert on the matter. And I talk about that being related to the argument from authority, where we would much rather believe that the experts around us have the inside scoop than we would like. Then we'll put more emphasis on what they tell us than we will on looking at the raw stats and statistics. The facts and figures, because we're so social, we'd rather believe in predictions from experts, even though predictions from experts almost universally fail.
Before you go, David, a lot of these misconceptions point to a big psychological trend here, I think, that we so desperately want to understand the world that we're willing to use all sorts of justifications and rationales for drawing conclusions at all. Why are we so hesitant to say, I don't know, or I don't understand?
It almost always plays into self-esteem models. And in psychology, there are two large branches that discuss how we protect our self-esteem. There's cognitive dissonance theory, and there's also self-perception theory. And both of those theories agree with the idea that so much of our behavior, so much of what we think, feel, and do the sources that are influencing those things are almost completely invisible to us. They're beneath the level of conscious introspection. But that doesn't prevent us from believing that we can introspect. And so we are sort of the unreliable narrator of the story of our life. And as we explain our thoughts and actions and behaviors, we do it as if we were explaining the thoughts and actions and behaviors of another person, but not just any other person, someone who is, we are the biggest fan of this person. We think of ourselves as above average in almost every category. And it's important to do that because self-efficacy a lot of times comes from a healthy dose of self-delusion. It's just when we cross the line or we create policies that don't take that into account, we can get ourselves into real trouble.
You know, one of the things that makes me most respect a guest on this show is if they answer, I don't know, to a question. Not that it's always relevant, but if somebody answers, I don't know, it means they decided to pass up an opportunity to fake their way through something. So my guest has been journalist, blogger, and psychology nerd, David McRaney. His new book is You Are Not So Smart, Why You Have Too Many Friends on Facebook, Why Your Memory is Mostly Fiction, and 46 Other Ways You're Deluding Yourself. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the filmmaker Werner Herzog on his new documentary. It's about the death penalty. Stay with us.